Welcome to the Deadcast.
May 6th, 1993, West Memphis, Arkansas. Members of the Crittenden County Search and Rescue Team scour a small area of thick, dense forest and brackish swamp water known as Robin Hood Hills. They are searching for 3 8-year-old boys, Stephen Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers. The three have been missing since the previous evening when one of the boys' adoptive fathers, John Mark Byers, called the police to report them missing. Just prior to that phone call, the three families had looked frantically for their children before enlisting the aid of law enforcement. Since that time, the families, the police, and numerous members of their neighborhood have scoured the area, desperate to find them. One of those helping to search that day is juvenile parole officer Stephen Jones. At roughly 1:45 in the afternoon of May 6th, he spots a boy's black shoe floating in a muddy creek. Reports are varied as to what happened next, but what is known is that Jones had attempted to retrieve the boy's shoe and ended up in the water. Making his way through the water and back towards shore, he feels something brush against his arm. A moment later, he reaches around, and then a body floats to the surface. It's one of the missing boys. He is naked and hogtied. Not long after, they will find the corpses of his friends, both of them in a similar state of undress and tied with shoelaces, each wrist bound to the opposing ankle. The murders shocked and horrified the community, and it wouldn't be long before suspects were identified and eventually arrested. The men accused of the murders would eventually be convicted, with the oldest one, Damien Eccles, receiving the death penalty. Though much publicity has been given to the case in the subsequent years, those three men who were convicted would forever be known as the West Memphis Three. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me again. As I'm sure you noticed from the trailer, it hasn't changed. We are still covering the West Memphis 3. Before we get into all of that, if you would like to follow me on Facebook and Instagram, it's at Ian Totten Author. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, it's Author Totten. If you would like to help support the show, you can find me on Venmo, PayPal, and Patreon at Ian Totten Author. Just a quick shout out to a friend of mine named Shard. He's going through a bit of a health crisis right now. He's a supporter of the show, and I just want to say, Shard, get well soon, man. I'm pulling for you, and I know a lot of other people are too. All right, now that the plugs are out of the way, sit back, relax, grab yourself something to drink. I've got my coffee and cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Before I go diving in about last week's episode, I received a lot of feedback on it, some of it positive, some of it negative. The show wasn't even up a full 24 hours before the Cancel Culture Kids, the West Memphis 3 supporters, came out in droves messaging me and flooding my timeline, both on Instagram and Facebook. That's really par for the course with these people. They don't have anything better to do with their life, and anyone who dares give an opposing viewpoint is automatically the enemy. I don't have time for them and their simple-minded ways. That being said, we're going to dive back into the case. I will be touching on the documentaries and the books that have been made on this case throughout, and I just want you to know my opinion, the majority of them aren't worth the paper and film they're printed on, as there's a lot of stuff that was intentionally left out of them, altered facts, you name it. Berlinger and his partner, they like to slant films. They've done it with every movie they've ever done. This isn't conjecture. If you ask them, they'll flat out tell you that they like to put their spin on things and present their story. Not the story, but their story. What I'm doing here is trying to get the actual facts of the case as they were presented at trial out. Not all of this conspiracy theory bullshit, Terry Hobbs did it, we don't have any proof, but he did it stuff. I don't have time for any of that crap unless there's actual evidence that shows Terry Hobbs did it. He's innocent. The fact of the matter is, the three men that were convicted in a court of law. They're still been convicted of it. They're all still felons. None of them can vote. None of them can own a weapon. Why? Because they're convicted child killers. And they will be until the day they die. And we're going to get into that at the end of either this episode or possibly the next episode. As far as what happened with three convicted killers. And what has happened with them since they got out of prison after copping a plea deal, because it was the only way to get Damien off of death row. That being said, we left off last week right around February of 93. Damien was back in counseling. He had gotten Social Security. He was telling his counselors that he was a sociopath, that he was homicidal and suicidal. This is on tons of paperwork. Something that's not often discussed, however, is the disturbing, abhorrent behavior that he engaged in towards members of the opposite sex who are quite a bit younger than him. Once again, I am using the books by Gary Meese, Blood on Black and Where the Monsters Go, as well as the case files found on the Callahan website. The books that Meese wrote are pretty much just a chronological order of what has happened in the case, both before the arrest and after. My personal opinion, although he disputes this, is that Gary Meese is an expert on this case. He lived and worked in West Memphis at the time. And unlike a lot of the looky-loos that have become attached to the case since it originally happened, he was on the ground, he saw firsthand what was going on, he knew a lot of the police officers that were involved in this case. The other acts that Damien committed are pretty twisted. One actually involves implied violence. It was really terrorizing someone. He was known throughout West Memphis. He was constantly walking from one place to another. Everyone knew him. He's about 6 foot tall, jet black hair and a trench coat, constantly with a sneer on his face. He's tried to portray this off in recent years as he was a misunderstood youth. That isn't the case. He is what he is, and he was what he was. He was a time bomb looking for a place to go off. One of the things that he would do is he had a habit of stalking people. One of them being his ex-girlfriend, Deanna Holcomb. At one point after he had come back to West Memphis, he still couldn't get the girl out of his head, which I can't fault him for that. I was young once. I think all of us know when you have that first true love and you break up and it's really hard to get them out of your head and you're out in town and stuff and hoping you're going to see him, that that's a normal thing. What is not normal is to find out that she's attending church with her family and then go out of your way to be at that church in the hopes that you can get to talk to her again. He talked about this in his 2012 book, Life After Death. He doesn't really give a timeline of when it happened, although in the book, it's the chapter right before the May 5th killings are discussed. One thing of interest, however, is that after he was arrested, news began to get around town about Eccles or someone who looked very similar to him observing children in what can only be described as a disturbing manner. One of the earliest reports comes from March 1st, 1993, when Jennifer Ball, who lived in Lakeshore, reported that she had been threatened by Michael Beshears, aged 14, on several occasions. On that day of March 1st, she said someone had threatened to kill her by shouting through a window. The police report describes Suspect B, who is not Beshears, as a slim white male, about 18, dressed in a black t-shirt, black jeans, and a black jacket. Jennifer saw him make the threats before entering the fenced-in backyard. On June 10th of 1993, Jennifer gave a handwritten statement to police concerning this incident. I'm going to read the letter she had, or the note she had given to police, and this is important as this happened on a number of different occasions, things of a similar nature. The first time I had contact with Damien Eccles was when he was at my window, March 1st, 1993. I had heard about him and heard that he was into devil worshiping. So was Michael and Amanda Lancaster. Well, Michael had told her that he was going to blow up my house and stay away from me. Well, she didn't believe him, and we continued to be friends. Well, he called her one day and told her to watch out, that he had Mark Berkshire's and Damien Eccles watching us. All this was happening in March. About March 1st, I was on three-way with Amanda Lancaster and Jack Held. It was storming that day. I kept on hearing something, but I thought it was just the rain. While I was in the kitchen, I was looking out the window and somebody jumped in front of it shouting, "You bitch, I'll get you, I'm gonna kill you, you're gonna die." I started screaming and hollering. I didn't know what to do. I dropped down in the corner of the kitchen. Amanda was hollering at me, "Jennifer, what is wrong? Jennifer, what is going on?" I told her that someone was at my window and it looked like Damien. She told me to stay where I was and she was going to call me right back. I hung up the phone. I looked out the window to see if he was still there. He was. He just glared at me and said, "You're dead, bitch," and ran off. I was so scared. Amanda called me back and I was crying. I told her what Damien had said. She just sat there like, "Oh my God." About 5 minutes later, she said, "Jennifer, Jennifer, was Damien wearing pure black and a black trench coat?" I said, "Yes, why?" She said, "He's walking down the street and eyeing my house." She got real scared and started crying, and then her house alarm went off. She was screaming and crying. I don't know what to do. I had a feeling that Damien was going to be watching us and after us. When my mom, Teresa Woodson, got home from work that day, I told her what had happened. She didn't know what to do. She waited for my stepdad, Don Woodson, to get home. She told him about it. He really didn't know what to do either. Me and my mom were talking, and she asked me to describe Damien. I told her that he had black hair and these eyes that looked black. He was dressed in a black shirt, black jeans, and a black trench coat. She asked me if he was tall. I told her yes. She said she remembered seeing him in Walmart. This was about 10 minutes after he had done passed by Amanda's house and came up to mine. She decided to call the police. Officer Reese came to our house. She asked me to describe Damien. I did. She asked me if I was sure it was Damien. I told her no. I was scared that if Damien found out I told, he would definitely kill me. So the person at my window was left blank. Well, about a month ago, I was in Kroger. I had left my mother to go get something. While I was looking, I noticed that somebody kept passing by and looking at me. When I looked up, I discovered that it was Damien. I just ran off. I didn't tell my mom because I didn't want her to worry, so I let it slide by. About 3 weekends ago, I went skating with Amanda Lancaster. We were having a good old time until Damien walked in. I looked at Amanda and pointed. She said, oh my god. I told her I was going to call my mom. She told me to just ignore him. Well, me and Amanda were walking around the skating rink. We decided to sit down and get something to drink. We were about 2 tables over from Damien, Jason Baldwin, and his girlfriend Heather. I don't know her last name. Well, we were all singing and having a good time. I noticed that Damien kept on staring at me. I just ignored it, or at least I tried to. I looked up and noticed that him and Jason were whispering to each other and pointing at me. Damien whispered something to Jason, and Jason looked over at me and said, I don't know. Then Jason whispered something to Damien, and Damien looked at me. He looked me up and down and said, yep. Then Damien started saying something, and Jason kept saying, no, man, no. Well, we finally left that table and went walking around. We went to the back of the skating rink. I noticed that Damien had followed us, not with his body, but with his eyes. It was really starting to freak me out. My best friend Shannon Sanders was up there. She noticed that I had been acting paranoid. She kept on asking me what was wrong. I told her I was just tired. Finally, on Sunday, I told her what was the matter. I had lost Amanda and was trying to find her. I went to the bathroom to see if she had walked in there. When I came out, Damien was standing there against the wall. I bumped into him. I didn't realize who it was until I looked up. When I looked into his eyes, it was like I froze. I just stood there. It's like something clicked and I came back to reality. I ran off. His eyes followed me all the way to the back. I didn't really say anything to Amanda because I didn't want to get her scared. We stayed at the back for about 10 minutes and decided to go back up to the front. Well, some girl, I can't remember her name, I really didn't know her, asked me to go buy her some candy and a Coke. When I went to give it to her, I noticed she was at Damien's table. I just ran over there and handed it to her and walked off. I could feel his eyes following me. Well, I later found out that he was asking some people who I was. Some girl that I didn't know told him I was Jennifer Ball. He sat there for a minute and then said, Jennifer Ball, Jennifer Ball, I know her. I really, really know her. And had this evil look on his face. Then he started asking around what Amanda's phone number was and where she lived. No one would tell him. While we were walking out of the blue, Amanda started saying, shut up, shut up. I looked at her and asked her what was wrong. She said that she could hear Damien in her mind saying, bitch, you're gonna die. You know too much. Last year, Amanda had PE with Damien. She said he would sit there and enter her mind. It really freaked her out. Well, it was finally time for us to leave, and I was glad. Damien watched us as we went out the building. Ever since then, it feels like someone is watching me. Friday, after everyone had found out who murdered the little boys, I got a phone call. I answered the phone, and someone asked me who this was. I said, Jennifer. They said, well, you and your friend Amanda were the next to die by Damien, and hung up. I was really freaked. I didn't say anything to Amanda about the phone call. I had heard that Damien was going to kill 2 more girls, his girlfriend and Jason Baldwin's girlfriend. Well, Jason's girlfriend is a girl named Heather, whom is Amanda Lancaster's cousin. I don't know her last name. Amanda kept on saying, Friday, I know those 2 girls were me and you. I know they were. I just told her not to jump to conclusions, even though after the phone call, I was certain it was us. After Amanda read that statement in the commercial appeal, she kept on saying, I have a feeling our picture is in that briefcase. I have the weirdest feeling. I just wish somebody would find out. Then yesterday, some woman that had come swimming with my aunt told my mom that she heard Damien was going to sacrifice 2 virgins next. I told my mom about the mysterious phone call. She asked me how come I hadn't told her. I told her I thought it was a prank, but now I'm really not sure. It's just really scary. Now I feel like everywhere I go I'm being followed. I haven't had any phone calls since Friday. So that's just, you know, an example. Jennifer's mother, as well as Amanda, also gave statements concerning both Eccles being in their backyard and stalking the two girls at the skating rink. Another instance that was brought to the police's attention was again also on June 10th when Karen Bashir's McGatty told the police that roughly 2 months before, her daughter, Jessica, who was 11, and a friend had been waiting outside to go to church at 10 a.m. on Sunday. They eventually came into the house and told their mother that a man was taking pictures of them. She gave this statement on June 11th. On Sunday morning, approximately 2 to 3 weeks before the triple murder occurred, my daughter and a friend were outside playing in my front yard at 515 Belvedere. They came into the house and said there was a man watching them from a bush one house away. I immediately went to the door, and when I opened it, he got up from a squatted position and started to run toward Balfour Road. I called my husband, and he and I immediately started looking for the man. We looked all over the neighborhood, the bayou behind Balfour. He just disappeared, and we could not see him. The guy behind the bush was Damien Eccles. I saw him clearly, and there is no doubt. I was told later that at that time he was staying with a family on Balfour. My daughter said the guy had something in his hand. My daughter believed that he was taking pictures of her and her friend at the time. Now, the daughter, Jessica, also gave a statement about this particular incident, and in it she said that they could tell that the man was playing with something in his pocket, moving his hand back and forth as he watched the two of them. There's a couple other statements that run along this same line, and it seems that whoever this individual was, whether it was in fact Damien Eccles or someone else, was playing pocket pool with themselves while they were watching small children. So you can see from this that there was obviously something quite wrong with Eccles leading up to the murders. Baldwin, too, who has been described as a sweet, innocent boy, also had a propensity for violence, and we are going to get into that at this point. And I want to remind you that all the stuff I'm talking about and have been talking about was all stuff the police discovered after the fact. After they spoke with Jesse Miss Kelly for, I think it was the second time, and he's going to be the last of the three suspects I talk about because there's a whole lot going on with him. There's this image that has been put out of Jason Baldwin that he's this, you know, saccharine sweet gosh, golly gee willikers speaking kind of individual. But there is he has a history with the police and with what can only be described as strange events surrounding his life prior to the murders on May 5th. The first of which is on June 5th of 1987. The home that the Baldwin Grinnell family was living in, one of the bedrooms was set on fire. Now, I couldn't find any documentation of this other than the fact that it did take place, but his little brother at that point was much too small to be able to have done it, and both parents attested that neither of them were responsible. He was also placed on probation at the age of 11, although we cannot find out why that was because juvenile records are sealed. When he was 12, he, his brother Matt, and several other youths broke into a building and proceeded to vandalize and destroy property in what has been called an antiques car store, They busted out windows, kicked dents into the doors, that kind of stuff. They were eventually caught by two men who found them jumping up and down on top of the cars, and the boys were charged with breaking and entering and criminal mischief. Some people look at this and say it was boys being boys. The county prosecutor thought it was a little more serious than that. And since we really don't have an idea of how much damage they caused, this is all we have to look at. It was recommended by this prosecutor that the boys all be placed into a reform school for 2 years. At the age of 15, he shoplifted from Walgreens, and he was placed on diversion of judgment for a year, which basically meant nothing would happen if he stayed in school and stayed out of trouble. He also recounted in a school paper how he had choked his brother unconscious at one point. In fact, he was pretty gleeful about talking about this. And the reason he did this was because his brother would not listen to him. Again, he had a violent past, was nowhere near where Eccles was at that point, but people did note that he began to take on Damien's manner of dress as well as his mannerisms. So there's some speculation that he may have taken on other aspects of Damien's personality. One thing that can be noted, however, is that the day the arrests were made, Baldwin's own grandmother expressed her belief to the local paper that her grandson most certainly could be involved in it, and that she had suspected as much as soon as the murders were discovered. There could be a number of contributing factors to Jason's behavior, as well as, you know, what was to come on May 5th. His mother, Gail, had been confined to mental institutions off and on throughout the years, had attempted suicide, a dozen times or more, at one point attempting it when the boys decided that they wanted to go live with their birth father. And Jason was the one who found her and called the 911 over this. Another instance of violence in Jason's past is that his stepfather was a violent alcoholic who would routinely hit Jason, his brother, as well as the mother. And in a few weeks before the murders occurred, Jason actually attacked the man with a baseball bat and drove him from the home. One key piece of evidence concerning Baldwin is that when the police came and raided their house on June 3rd of 93, his mother, Gail, accused the stepfather, who had returned at that point, of turning Jason in for the reward money. And when questioned about this later, she could give no reasonable explanation as to why she had said it. Another interesting thing is that on June 6th, the evening of Gail Grinnell and someone who was dubbed as Mr. Grinnell, who I suspect was probably her boyfriend at the time, Dink Dent, they showed up at the Hobbs' house, and this was testified to by both Pam Hobbs and her husband Terry. And why this is significant is that the Hobbs family did not know the Baldwin clan at all, and there was no reason for them to have come over to the house in an attempt to supposedly console the family. And while Jason has consistently tried to paint himself as, you know, again, this aw shucks type of kid, he painted a different portrait of himself in Mara Levert's awful book, Dark Spell, where he talked about how when he was put in prison, he quickly showed his dominance over the other inmates through assaults. And if you've had the misfortune of reading that book, it's almost laughable to hear how Baldwin describes how he would, you know, attack other prisoners and call them bitch and other such things. While he wormed his way into the good graces of the guards and the warden to get himself a cushy job. And Gary Meese's book, he, I think, pretty accurately describes Baldwin and Eccles and compares them to the Columbine killers as far as one was a manic depressive with, you know, delusions of grandeur, while the other one was a sociopath. And I think that's really, you know, the case here. I don't believe that Eccles was the sociopath. I think it really was Baldwin. I think he was the impetuous drive behind the killings, and he knew that Damien would help him to carry these out. Even, the stories Baldwin has told about his time in prison paint a picture that is starkly different to the public persona he has presented over the years. He really shows himself to be a cunning, conniving individual that will do whatever it is he has to in order to obtain what he wants. We're going to leave Jason Baldwin at this point, and we're going to dive into Jessie Miss Kelly. Now, Miss Kelly had a fairly long rap sheet and was known around the trailer park, the Lakeshore Trailer Park, as a troublemaker. This has been well documented, as well as his supposed mental retardation. And it'd be a lie to say that Jessie Miss Kelly Jr. is a smart individual by any stretch of the imagination. But there is footage out there of his lawyers saying that he needed to dumb it down a bit. And almost immediately after this is when we got this picture of Jesse as, you know, barely able to tie his own shoes, let alone walk and chew gum at the same time. Like I said, he wasn't a smart individual. I've seen different things, one of them putting his IQ at around 69, another around 73. See, he's not playing with a full deck, but he's not an idiot. He most certainly is not what has been portrayed in all of the various media about this case. If anything, he is a violent alcoholic who is easily manipulated by individuals who have a better grasp on reality into doing things that are against his best interest. He was constantly on probation growing up. He was a high school dropout. There were numerous calls of him hitting younger children unprovoked. One in which he picked a rock up and threw it at a girl that was, I think, 10 or 11 for no reason. And another where he walked up and hit a girl in the face. Another one where he beat somebody up, some kid up, because he thought that the guy was abusing his girlfriend. This was common practice for Jessie Miss Kelly. And I'm going to give a quick rundown of Miss Kelly's various crimes before diving into some of the evidence against the West Memphis Three, how they came to be arrested, as well as their various alibis, which, as you will see, they really don't have, despite, you know, what their supporters try to claim. One incident involved a 14-year-old boy who said that he and some friends were walking on the railroad tracks that were near Lakeshore when a group of boys that included Baldwin, Miss Kelly, Buddy Lucas, Damien Eccles, and a number of others approached them. The boy said that at first, Miss Kelly was talking to him before pulling a knife out of his pocket and putting it to the boy's throat. Then the older boys all began beating on this kid, to the point that when he eventually was able to go home, he stated that he had been coughing up blood, and this further proves to illustrate the point that Miss Kelly, Eccles, and Baldwin did hang out prior to May 5th of 1993. Another incident was the 13-year-old girl. Miss Kelly was telling people around the trailer park that he was having sex with her, and she confronted him with it. She eventually ended up slapping him, and she didn't hear anything for about a year, until she and her boyfriend were walking when Miss Kelly, who was apparently out looking for them, attacked both of them, hitting first her boyfriend and then her, before continuing the assault, at which point the two of them ran away. And apparently it went further than this, as Jesse's girlfriend, as well as a number of other people, let the girl, her mother, as well as her boyfriend know that if Jesse ended up in jail over this, then all of them would come looking for them. I was just looking through my notes. The incident where Miss Kelly threw the rock at the girl and hit her in the head had actually, the girl was 5 or 6 years old, not 10 or 11, and he was actually on probation for this when he was arrested for the murder. On May 4th of 1988, when he was 11, there's the story that I mentioned earlier of Miss Kelly beating up a girl's boyfriend after hitting her in the head with either a rock or a brick. It was unclear to the girl at the time which he had hit her with. Before that, he had stabbed a fourth grade classmate in the mouth with a pencil. There were a lot of other incidents very similar to this. Some of the rage that he had can be attributed to his father. For a lot of accounts that I have seen has stated that he was very similar to Jesse in his alcoholism as well as his aggressiveness. Before I dive into the evidence, I want to touch on something real quick that I spoke about last week, which was the FBI profiler John Douglas saying that none of the boys convicted for this crime had anything in their history that would implicate them committing this type of a crime. I think I have shown at this point, just with the barest of facts that I've gone over, that they indeed did have violent tendencies and were quite capable of committing these acts. Again, Douglas's words should be taken with a full bag of salt, as he was paid by the defense team to give this assessment, so it's not like he came to this conclusion on his own. If you ask any defense lawyer, they're not going to use somebody that's going to hurt their case. Meaning that, you know, they're not going to hire somebody, that person gives them, you know, a statement or a response that is going to negatively affect their case, and then defense team's going to allow that to become public. If he had turned around and said, you know, I definitely think these boys had done this crime, we never would have heard about John Douglas being involved with this case. Now for some of the evidence. There were fibers found on the bodies of Michael, Stevie, and Christopher that were consistent with bathrobes found, I believe, in the Baldwin house. I think there was some carpet fibers and shirt fibers found as well. On one of the shirts, there was some blue wax that was consistent with a blue candle that was found inside the Eccles home. There was also what appeared to be semen on one of the pair of jeans. And this is important when I get into Miss Kelly's later confessions. But I want you to keep in mind this was 1993, not 2018. You know, CSI, the television show, has really popularized this idea that the police can, you know, instantly almost pinpoint a criminal with DNA evidence, etc., etc. That isn't the case. Yes, they can find some suspects, provided that the evidence has not deteriorated or been compromised in some manner. What you see inside shows like CSI and other ones of that nature is, you know, Hollywood magic, because they have to have, you know, a way to solve this mystery that they've presented to the viewer. A lot of times, especially back then, DNA evidence was absolutely useless other than giving an idea of the blood type that DNA would be consistent with. In this case, the DNA found on the pair of jeans was extremely contaminated. It had been in the water for about 8 hours by the time it was found, so they really weren't going to be able to do much other than tell what it was. There was also a knife that was found in the lake behind the Baldwin household. This is what's been referred to as the lake knife. And the West Memphis 3 have contended that they didn't put it there, and that, you know, Jason Baldwin's mother found it, threw it in the lake, or that Jason himself had done so long before the murders happened. But it has been shown that it is possible that this knife was used in the murders. It was kind of a Rambo-type knife with the serrated edge and the blood grooves on the back. But there was also a round opening in the handle of the knife. And one of the things that has been postulated, especially at trial, is that a compass had been set into the handle of a knife, and that is what made the circular wound that was found in one of the boys' heads. And naturally, they were unable to find the compass, which leads me to believe that there's a possibility that it was lost after the fact, or it was intentionally removed before the knife was thrown into the lake. So that's just some of the evidence that is out there. There is more, although I'm not gonna spend 45 minutes digging into it. There was also an axe pendant that was found that had blood drops on it that was consistent with both one of the boys as well as one of the killers. This was not put into the trial because it was discovered too late to be admissible. At that point, the prosecution already rested their case. There also was some hairs and whatnot found, one from a black male, some consistent with Terry Hobbs, which, given the fact that he was the adoptive father of one of the boys, is not unlikely, as well as hair that was possibly from the suspects, and hair that was found not to belong to any of those involved. Now, as to how the suspects came to the police's attention, the police looked at upwards of 70 different individuals, from Vietnam veterans, violent felons, to sex offenders, trying to get an idea of who possibly could have done this. And as I stated in the last episode, Damien Eccles, probation officer, is the one who threw his name out there as a possible person of interest to the police. There were a few different people who were speculated about being involved. One was Mr. Bojangles. There was also a tattooed man that was said to have been seen near the area that a driver supposedly picked up not long afterwards. But all of these quickly fell to the wayside. There were two individuals who had left West Memphis and gone to California right after the killings took place. That was Chris Morgan and Brian Holland. They were picked up in California, and although they supposedly failed a lie detector test, they were eventually cleared. Yeah, the one guy, Morgan, did confess after 17 hours of interrogation because of this failed polygraph test, but he immediately retracted this. But the names that kept popping up were Eccles, Miss Kelly, and Baldwin, with people repeatedly telling the police that either they had been told by somebody else, or they had been told by the killers themselves that they were responsible. Vicky Hutchinson was one of the people that came forward, as well as L.G. Hollinsworth, who some people actually consider to be the fourth suspect in this case. He was on and off the police radar with a number of people saying he was involved, that he had laundered the clothing for the boys. This includes his aunt by Mary, Vicky Hutchinson. LG's a difficult nut to crack, as he died in a car accident. Personally, I believe he was probably involved in cleaning up after the fact in some way, shape, or form, but we'll really never know. Now, a woman named Dixie Hubbard, who had at one point been a Hollinsworth, she was brought into this case after a tipster said she had seen two boys and a girl come into the laundromat that she worked at to clean mud and blood off of their clothing. This is the same laundromat that Vicky Hutchinson had gone to pick up her mother at. And when the police spoke with Dixie, she said that it was LG who had come in to the laundromat in a small light-colored car, and that it was he who had laundered the clothing. So stories were flying around about the three killers before they were ever picked up. This went on for roughly 2 months. One thing, however, that did not make it to the police's radar right away was the fact that Jessie, Miss Kelly, started talking about the murders the day after they occurred. In fact, there was a guy named Buddy Lucas who Jessie knew, and he gave a pair of shoes to Lucas the next day, stating that he couldn't stand to look at them any longer, because they had been worn during the killings. And according to Lucas, these shoes did have blood on them when he received them. He also said that when Miss Kelly began to talk to him about the murders, Miss Kelly was sweating profusely and began to cry. And this is consistent with a number of other people that said that Miss Kelly confessed to them, in that everyone stated Miss Kelly was crying over the fact that he had been involved in the murders. As I said, a number of other people told similar stories, but it was Vicky Hutchinson, you know, contacting the police and talking to them on a number of different occasions that actually led to the police bringing in Jessie, Miss Kelly, and talking to him for the first time. Miss Kelly confessed on June 3rd of 1993, and there's been a lot of nonsense put out there that the police had brought him in without his father's permission, that they had interrogated him for 12 plus hours. That isn't the case. His father, Jessie Miss Kelly Sr., actually signed paperwork giving the police permission to speak with him. And they began speaking to him late in the morning of June 3rd, at around 10 a.m. He was interviewed by Detective Allen while another man, Detective Ridge, observed, and each man took separate notes on the case. Now, after giving a few conflicting stories about both Damien Echols and his whereabouts on May 5th, Miss Kelly agreed to take a lie detector test and was read his rights somewhere around 11 a.m., so about an hour after he had arrived at the police station. It was at this point that they went and found Jesse's father, who signed the waiver which allowed them to administer the polygraph test to Miss Kelly. At 11:30, Miss Kelly was given his Miranda rights once again, and he was administered three polygraph exams that day at 11:55, 12:03, and 12:11. At roughly 12:30 p.m., the man who had administered the tests, whose name was Durham, announced to the other officers that he believed Miss Kelly was lying. The basis for this was three no's that Miss Kelly had given. One was to a question of, had he ever been to Robin Hood Hills? Had he ever taken part in devil worship? Have you ever attended a devil worship meeting in the Turl area? Are you involved in the murder of those three boys? Do you know who killed these three boys? Miss Kelly broke down upon being informed that he had failed the polygraph test. This was about 12:40-ish, and from 12:40 until 2:20, he was interrogated again. Miss Kelly admitted that he saw Baldwin and Echols commit the murders. This is really important, as it's the crux of what led to all three killers going to prison. Miss Kelly initially downplayed his involvement in the murders greatly, and when they began recording the interrogations, he gave a few answers that were wrong, such as the time of day. I believe he said it took place during the morning, as well as saying that the boys were tied with ropes instead of shoelaces. Later, during one of his other confessions, he admitted that he had thrown these bits of information at the police in order to try and fool them. Regardless, the story Miss Kelly told is that Baldwin had called him and asked him to come hang out. They were going to go look for girls. They met up, and Miss Kelly, who had been drinking, went with them into the woods over at Robin Hood Hills, where they continued drinking. They heard boys approaching through the woods, and Damien had Miss Kelly and Baldwin hide while he made some sort of sound in order to draw the boys' attention. When the boys approached, Echols attacked them. Very soon after this, Baldwin and Miss Kelly joined in on the assault. Now, one thing that should be noted is Miss Kelly repeatedly stated he only beat on one of the boys, to the point, in fact, that the boy was rendered unconscious, and that Baldwin and Echols did the majority of the assaults. Now, I'm going to read from Miss Kelly's first confession. I want to warn anyone listening who has a bit of a squeamish stomach that he was pretty descriptive as far as what happened during this assault. And in fact, his later confessions, he was pretty consistent with what happened. I do want to note that there's a couple of things that Miss Kelly threw out that have never been proven nor disproven, so I'm not really touching on them as I go over the case. One of these was the fact that he said Echols and Baldwin had a briefcase that had pictures of the boys inside of it. The boys being Byers, Branch, and Moore. And that he had seen these pictures at a cult meeting that he was at. The reason that I'm not really getting into this is because this briefcase was never found. There's also another person who people called Lucy or Lucifer, who's supposed to be the cult leader that lived in Lake Shore. no evidence has ever been found to prove or disprove the existence of this individual, and that's why I am not really getting into them at all, as neither of these things is pertinent to the actual facts of the case. So here are a few excerpts from Miss Kelly's first confession. Gitchell: which boys were raped? Jesse: Byers and the Branch. Gitchell: okay, so you know them by name and face well enough to call them by name? Jesse: uh-huh. Gitchell: okay, did you see the Moore boy? Was he raped? Jesse: no. Gitchell: all right, who raped these two boys? Jesse: Damien and Jason. Gitchell: do you know which one raped which boy, or how did that happen? Jesse: Damien raped the Myers by himself, and Jason and Damien raped the Branch. Gitchell: all right, give that to me again now. Jesse: Damien raped the Myers by himself, and Jason and Damien raped the Branch. Gitchell: did anyone have oral sex with the boys? Jesse: yes, Damien and Jason. Gitchell: how many of them did they do that to? Jesse: just two, Branch and Byers. Gitchell: how did they keep the boys quiet? Jesse: put their hands over their mouths. Gitchell: did they do anything else other than put their hands over their mouths? How did they finally keep them from being quiet? Because the boys bound to have been hollering. Jesse: they stuck their hands over their mouths first, and then they stuck their shirts in their mouths. Gitchell: okay, did they do anything else to them or make them be quiet? Jesse: they stuck their thing in their mouth. Gitchell: okay, were they hitting them before that or afterwards? Jesse: before and after, just trying to keep them off of them. Gitchell: just all the time? Jesse: just trying to keep Jason and Damien off of them. Gitchell: now they put their, whose shirts did they put in their mouth? Jesse: Damien's. Gitchell: okay, all right, hold on just a minute. Let me ask you something else, Jesse. I'm sorry, I keep coming back and forth, but I got people that want me to ask you some other questions. Talking about oral sex, did you see? You know, we talked earlier about how Jason and Damien do each other, have sex with each other. Did they have oral sex on the boys? Jesse: yeah. They, one of them stuck their thing in one of the boy's mouth while the other one got the other one up the butt and stuff. Gitchell: okay, but did anyone go down on the boys and maybe suck theirs or something? Jesse: not that. I didn't see nothing. Neither one of them do that. Gitchell: you didn't see that? Jesse: uh-uh. This following is another excerpt from Jesse's confession. Gitchell: how did they force these boys to have oral sex on them? How did they have a hold of them? Jesse: one of them had holding them by the arms while the other one got behind them and stuff. Gitchell: did he ever hold him up here? Or Jesse: the one that was holding him up there at the front, grabbing him by his headlock. Gitchell: had him in a headlock? Did he have him any other way? Jesse: he was holding him like this by the head, like this and stuff. Note: was indicating the victim was being held by their ears. Gitchell: could he have been holding him up here like that? Jesse: I was too far away. He was holding him up here by his head like this. Note: showed the same as above. Gitchell: so, Jesse: and he was pulling him. Gitchell: okay. So who was one of them doing that, or both of them doing it? Was Jason? Jesse: Jason was holding him while Damien did it, and then they took turns. Gitchell: so they both did it to all three of these boys? Jesse: just them two, so far as I know. Gitchell: just the two of them? Jesse: yes. Gitchell: but Jason and Damien, did they do it to two of the boys and they took turns? Jesse: uh-huh. Gitchell: and they would hold, tell me again about their hands. I mean, I know you're holding it up here, Jesse, it was up here by their heads and stuff, and was just pulling and stuff. Gitchell, all wrote. So they are up here, had their hands, Jesse, by their ears, and pulling them and stuff. Gitchell, all right, okay. Say that again for me now. Jesse, holding them up by their head, by ears, and pulling. Gitchell, okay. Jesse went on to describe how Damien had initially beaten the boys with a large stick that he had brought with him. It was a walking stick that people around West Memphis were familiar with seeing him carry. He also talked about how Jason was the one that produced the knife and began stabbing. He stated he only stabbed the one boy before taking the knife and cutting off the boy's penis, although at other points he did state that he only cut off the testicles. It's important to note that Jesse severely diminished his own participation in the murders during this interrogation, stating that when they started cutting on the boys, he took off and went home because it made him sick to his stomach. But he also stated that he had seen them go into the water with the boys at that point before, stating again that he had taken off because it made him sick to his stomach. Again, Miss Kelly was back and forth during this interrogation and confession, claiming that he had seen things and then later saying, oh no, I didn't see that. It would be shown, though, later on when he gave his subsequent confessions that he was there for the entire thing. The only part that he refused to admit any participation in was placing the boys into the water and the sexual assaults. He consistently denied being involved in that. This is it. This was enough for the police to go out and arrest Jason Baldwin and Damien Eccles, and they did that. And you can actually see some footage of Damien in custody when in the first Paradise Lost film. And this is where a lot of that misconception about who and what Damien Eccles comes from is that the filmmakers portrayed him in a very sympathetic light, refusing to take into account the statements that he had given to the police prior to being arrested. Almost instantly, Damien had an alibi. He stated that he was on the phone the entire night with various girls, and this was shot to ribbons when the police talked to these girls and found out that he hadn't been on the phone with them all night. In fact, one of the girls stated that she called a number of times throughout the night to speak with him, only to be told by his grandmother that he was not home. And it was between 10 and 10:30 when she was finally able to get a hold of him. Jason Baldwin, on the other hand, came out and said that he had been at his uncle's house mowing the lawn after school, and that Dominie and Damien had been with them, after which he went home and played video games or talked on the phone with various girls into the night. Although none of these girls were able to corroborate his alibi at all, and eventually Jason's mom stepped in and refused to allow him to speak with police further. Damien eventually changed his alibi when his sister and mother got involved, and they said that they had been at a friend's house that night, all of them together, watching 90210. This too was shot to ribbon when members of this family were put on the stand to testify, and they basically flubbed the entire alibi. One thing that needs to be noted here is that to this day, everyone pretty much agrees that Baldwin had been at his uncle's house that afternoon mowing the lawn. He still claims to have a rock-solid alibi for the night in question, although he has never presented one
to the public or to the police. And his mother's boyfriend at the time, Dink Dent, who was living with the family, stated that he did not see Jason all night until about 9 or 9:30, while Damien still continues to cling to this alibi of he was on the phone all night talking to girls, despite the fact that not a single one of these girls has come forward and said, you know, I was mistaken on the times and that we were on the phone all night. Under oath, all of these girls have stated that they were not on the phone with him that evening until 10 or 10:30. Even his mother, I believe, stated that he had gotten into a fight with Dominique that night, later that night, because of him being on the phone with Jason Baldwin's girlfriend at some point. But all of this took place after 10 o'clock, well after the suspected window when the murders took place, which is from roughly 5:30 up until 8:30 that evening. Jesse Miss Kelly at first said that he had been working all day and that he had gone home and did not leave again that night. This was changed when it was presented to him that he had gotten off of work around noon, and he changed this to that he had been around a trailer park and he was there when the police were called twice, as one woman had smacked another woman's child and that he had spoken to the police. People did put him on the scene at that point. Unfortunately, the police officers who were on the scene knew Miss Kelly, and all of them stated under oath that he was not on scene when this happened. Conversely, he also said that he had gone to wrestling that night. What this was apparently Miss Kelly and a group of other youths had found somebody that had a wrestling ring, and they would rent it out for the evening and go up there and practice. And Miss Kelly stated that he had had his wrestling mask with him. Apparently, he was going to be a masked wrestler in the veins of El Santo or something. But he said that he had smacked his head off of the post on the outside of the ring and sat the rest of the night out. The guy who had arranged for the trip stated that they had gone that evening, but when he produced the receipt for this, it showed that it was on a different night than May 5th. So Miss Kelly's alibi that he was wrestling was, again, shot to pieces. Even if we suppose that it's true that Miss Kelly had, in fact, gone with his friends wrestling that evening, and that the person who had written out the receipt had mistakenly put the wrong date, they did not leave until much later that evening, which, again, left Miss Kelly's whereabouts for the time of the murders in question. I think we're going to leave the case off here for this week. I was hoping to get it done in 2 weeks, but I honestly suspected that it would be more than that. So next week, I'm going to wrap up looking at the West Memphis 3. I'm going to discuss the rest of Jesse's confessions, and yes, I mean just that, there were multiple confessions with this case. After his first confession, he confessed, I think, 5 more times, none of them with any prodding whatsoever, and that threw a big monkey wrench into the entire defense for everyone involved. Also gonna briefly discuss the trials, the aftermath, and what has happened in the ensuing years, including the supposed new DNA evidence that would exonerate them, which never came to be released, as well as I'm going to briefly touch on these absolutely insipid programs that came out on Lifetime. I think it was last year, or maybe it was 2018 or 19, that this firefighter put out where he said that he was gonna get to the root of the matter and, you know, find the real killer, and he basically just jerk the three killers off in order to make some money from a TV deal. He didn't come out with any new evidence. He didn't prove anything. He just spit out a bunch of half-truths and all of the other crap that has come out of the supporters' camp over the ensuing years. That's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed my second look into the West Memphis 3. I am going to recommend a book for this week. It is the two books that Gary Meese wrote, Blood on Black and Where the Monsters Go. He also has a third book out, although the name of it escapes me at this moment, but it is basically a condensed version of the first two books. You can find those on Amazon. If you're interested in this case, I can't recommend them enough. If you enjoyed the Deskcast, I would ask that you please leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast site. It really does help the show. Until next week, I'm your host, Ian Totten. Stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deadcast.